This is Marathon Training Academy, episode 109.
Welcome to the Marathon Training Academy podcast. I'm Trevor.
And I'm Angie.
In this episode, we talk with Samantha Gash, an ordinary runner from Australia who decided to do the extraordinary. While in the midst of finishing up law school, she signed up for a 250-kilometer ultra-marathon across the driest desert in the world. You will hear all about her story and some tips on accomplishing your dreams. And for this episode's quick tip, we'll tell you about a running movie that will inspire you to be awesome. And to get our help in your training for your fall marathon, find out how to become a member of the Academy and get all of our premium content and resources by visiting our website, marathontrainingacademy.com. So, Angie, I was excited to go into iTunes and see our podcast on the homepage of the health category.
Yeah, that is great.
Yeah, and on the health and fitness category, too. So, things are going good. We appreciate everyone who has left us a 5-star review. All of those reviews help us get noticed by more and more people, keep us on the first page and high in the rankings. So, big word of thanks to everybody who's helped us out with that. And we are committed to keep providing the best show that we can provide and excited about the days ahead. Definitely excited about this episode. We had a good time talking with Samantha, and we know you're going to love her and love her story. But all kinds of awesome things to talk about. How about you, Angie? You feeling awesome? We're going to use that word a lot.
Awesome is the new epic, huh?
Right.
I did not feel awesome yesterday. I was so tired I went to bed at 8:30 p.m.
Yeah.
But then I woke up at 5:30 a.m. feeling awesome and went for my run. So it was a great way to start the day.
Yes. So what is going on in the running world out there, Angie? Tell us. Anything exciting? Anything awesome?
I might just slap you before this episode's over. Yes, it was just this past Sunday, June 1st, that the San Diego Marathon was held. And a lady named Harriet Thompson, age 91, set the world record for running the fastest marathon for her age group, which would be 90 and above. And I believe her 7-hour and 7-minute finish was 2 hours and 45 minutes faster than the previous record that was set.
Yeah.
So she really smashed through that milestone, and we were able to talk to her this week. We were hoping to turn it into an episode.
Yes.
But unfortunately, our recording equipment chose to fail.
Oh, yes.
It would have been so good. So we're going to have to recap it for you just because she's an amazing lady.
Yeah, that has never happened to us before. The audio just totally went corrupt, and we just totally lost everything. But we talked to her for, I don't know, 23 minutes. And she's 91 and very sharp.
Yes, she is.
She told us her story and how when she started running, kind of when the first running wave came along, it wasn't really popular and people didn't really understand why anybody would want to run. It's back in the 70s, I guess.
Yeah, why run when you have a perfectly good car?
Right. And she's done multiple marathons. She's a cancer survivor.
Well, she signed up for her first marathon when she was 76. A friend of hers was running the San Diego Marathon to raise money for the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. And so at age 76, she ran her first marathon. She's done 15 since then, approximately one a year. And she's just really a go-getter.
And very positive, too.
Yes, and she doesn't really see how there's anything special about her. We asked her what she would say to someone who thought they were too old to run a marathon. She's kind of chuckled. She's like, well, just look at me. If I can do it, anyone can.
Yeah.
And yeah, the amazing thing is she was just recently undergoing skin cancer treatment. Mm-hmm. And so she had all these horrible sores from radiation on her legs that were covered with bandages.
Right.
I'm sure that was very painful. But she ran with her son and just seemed really overwhelmed and delighted by all the media attention she got. She said she just felt like a celebrity, and she was just kind of blown away that people would think she was so amazing.
Yeah, she is amazing. And what is going on in the Academy? We have some new members we'd like to say a word of welcome to. Mindy from Pennsylvania, Monica from Ohio, Kathleen from Michigan, Dan from Missouri, Maria from California, and Brian from New Jersey. Glad to have you on board training with us.
And I'd like to say congratulations to Elspeth on finishing the Edinburgh Full Marathon in 3 hours and 54 minutes. And she ran for Parkinson's research and also became a marathon maniac that day. And she writes and says, "Thanks, Angie, for helping me get over yet another finish line. I only managed 3 hours and 54 minutes, but it felt like my most strong and focused race yet. This was my first race with my name on my chest, and in the final mile, everyone was cheering my name, and it felt brilliant. Thanks to MTA for being a great supportive community."
And you got to know, Elspeth, that I always have to coach Angie on how to say Edinburgh.
This next note comes from Jason in the UK. He wrote first a few weeks ago, and he says, "Hi, guys. I'm attempting 7 marathons in 7 days, starting on the 26th of May in the UK, basically because of you guys. You've kept me sane over the winter, and now after 9 months of training, I'm running with 3 fellow runners in aid of 7 amazing charities. It'll be 188.4 miles and an ultra to finish off." And then he just gave us an update a couple days ago, and he says, "We did it. 7 marathons in 7 days. Through the pain and determination deep within, on Sunday, I completed the dream. 9 months of planning came true yesterday. Also, I got to make an ill 6-year-old boy's dream come true. Thanks to both of you for inspiring and inspire here in the UK. God bless you all. Jason."
Well, I can't imagine how sore I would be after doing 7 marathons in 7 days. So, right on, Jason. I hope recovery is going well.
That's right.
If that's not awesome, then I don't know what is.
And this note comes from Casey. He says, "Trevor and Angie, I want to thank you for what you do. I've been listening for 4 years, and I've learned so much. I've improved my time over those 4 years by 20 minutes. I ran the Ogden Half Marathon in 1 hour and 38 minutes. Running has brought me so many wonderful gifts, it's hard to put into words. Most of all, it's made me mentally strong. I have had an entire life transformation since I started running. Your tagline is definitely true. Thanks for all your help along my journey."
All right, well, congratulations, Casey, on a faster half marathon. And I'm glad you've experienced some life transformation. That is great, and keep up the good work.
This last note comes from Brandon, and he says, "Hello, Trevor and Angie. My name is Brandon, and my family and I are missionaries. We work with indigenous tribes in central Mexico. We listen to your podcast down here and really appreciate the great advice and info y'all provide. I'm constantly motivated by your personal stories and testimonies. We have an incredible opportunity down here to train Tarahumara style, with both the trails available and the rich abundance of fresh fruits and vegetables. We are incredibly blessed to get to do what we do. Again, thanks for the podcast, and God bless."
So, yes, anywhere you live, you can live a healthy and active lifestyle. No matter what your occupation is or where you live, just go out and be awesome.
That's right.
So thank you, Brandon, for sending in that message.
Well, now we want to get into our interview with Samantha. She is a runner from Melbourne, Australia. And before we get in the interview, just say a word about what Samantha's going to talk about. She went on to run, actually not one, but 4 desert races, part of a series called Racing the Planet 4 Desert Grand Slam. And she is the first female and youngest person to ever finish this. So she'll tell us about all 4 desert races. So we're going to get into that right now. When it all comes round, everyone's someone. When it all comes round, everyone's someone. All right, we're on the podcast today with Samantha Gash. She's an ultra marathoner from Australia. In 2010, she became the first female and the youngest person to complete the Racing the Planet's 4 Deserts Grand Slam in 1 calendar year. This included 4 250-kilometer ultra marathons in the driest, windiest, hottest, and coldest deserts on Earth. And her story is featured in the movie Desert Runners, which Angie and I have seen and recommend. Samantha, welcome to the podcast today.
Hello, Trevor and Angie. How are you going?
Great. So tell us a little about yourself and how you first got into running.
Yeah, I suppose kind of leading into Desert Runners, I hadn't done a huge amount of running, definitely not of ultra marathons. In high school, I went to a really small girls' school, a school where you would participate in a lot of sports, but I'm not very good with ball sports. I'm pretty uncoordinated. And so I always was in the cross country team as, I suppose, the sport that I would, do. And I don't know, I really liked it. And I think I picked it up or picked up running a lot more in my final year of high school. And it was probably more as the only way I would have a justifiable, excuse from studying. It was my way of just unwinding and getting out there. And I suppose I just picked it up gradually more and more. I suppose the older I got, I did my first marathon in 2008. I think the training for me just blew my mind away about, I suppose, the commitment you need to be able to do a marathon and not be in much pain. But it was after doing my first marathon that I was assigned up to do the Atacama Desert in Chile.
And that is the first of the four desert races, right? Could you tell us about that race and some of the other of the race in the planet? Well,
yeah, I only ever signed up for the first race to begin with. And leading into the Atacama, I got an injury on my, I think it was my ankle. I was increasing the, I suppose, the distance that I was running, but also with the weight that I was having on my in my pack. So the Race in the Planet series, you have to carry everything in a pack on your back whilst you're running for the 5 or 6 days, which means all your clothes, all your food that you're going to eat. And so it becomes like this logistical challenge of how can you put the lightest weight, but I suppose still very high quality food and kit in your bag. So you become a bit of a pack horse, really. So I became injured because I just increased, I suppose, the amount of weight I would carry. And leading up to the race, I was in a moon boot for 6 weeks beforehand. And I remember asking if I could be a volunteer in the race, and they said they had enough volunteers, which shocked me. I was like, how can you ever have enough volunteers?
Right.
But then I thought, okay, well, I've got my flight there. I'm just going to walk it. And so I walked the first few days, and Chile is, I mean, the Atacama Desert's incredible. It's kind of characterized by these really challenging salt flats. And for those who have never run on salt flats, they're like, at times they're really sticking out jagged pieces of coral-like, I suppose, features on the ground. And sometimes you step on it and it doesn't break. Other times you step on it, it breaks and your foot sinks and you're kind of getting your foot out and, you know, you get cuts around your ankle. And it was a really hard race because it was just such different terrain. But it was also probably the most beautiful place of the world I've ever been. You know, the sunrises, sunsets were incredible. And maybe it was just because it was the first time I'd done something like that. It really sticks out in my mind as being this magical place. Now, I did that race, and weirdly enough, my injury recovered towards the end of the race. So I was pretty much just walking the first few days, and I looked around me and I saw that a lot of the guys, particularly in their mid-20s, their 30s, early 40s, they always would run really hard to begin with, really, really hard. And I was shocked by their pace, thinking, do they know that they're running for another 4 or 5 days? And I suppose my advantage out of being injured is that I got to just be an observer in a sense and learn a lot about what would work for someone who is maybe a bit inexperienced with ultramarathon running, particularly multi-stage ultramarathon running. And I learned the people that did the best in that sense were the ones that built up over the days, had the ability to kind of drop the ego at the start line and go, you know what, the speedsters are going to run out really hard. And you know what, I can probably catch them by the fifth day, which is the long stage of every race. And I was like, I caught up to people who were hours ahead of me on the shorter stages, and by the 74 kilometer stage, which is, you know, like 48 miles or something like that, I was catching up to people who I hadn't seen the whole race because they maybe had burnt themselves out a little bit in the first few days. So it was really interesting to observe that race.
Still, why would you want to take on a race that big? I mean, going from a marathon to a 250K, what gave you the inspiration to do that?
Well, a few things. Like, I wanted an adventure. I was a university student at the time, studying my law degree, and I met a lady from America called Linda Quirk, and she had, when I met her, she was doing 7 marathons and 7 continents, and she was telling me about this series, and I had briefly read a few blogs over the past few years about it, and I don't know, I wasn't as much, I suppose, excited by the running component, which might sound weird for deciding to do a 250-kilometer race. But I think I really was just excited about the idea of having an adventure. And when you do these races, what is so exciting, I think, in many respects, is that You meet people from all over the world. Each night you sleep in a tent with eight people, and I suppose very quickly you make friendships with people. And I think I gathered that from reading the blogs from past competitors, that people had this really incredible experience and then they would talk about the running. And so I think maybe my legal brain also liked the idea of all the logistical challenges, and there's heaps of those. I mean, just getting to the start line is a challenge in itself.
Probably very expensive.
Yeah. Yes, it is.
You mentioned carrying stuff, having to carry all your gear and I suppose food and stuff on your back the whole way. How much do you have to do versus what the race itself, the directors of the race provide? Because you sleep in tents, so probably they're setting up tents for you guys along the way, right?
That's the one thing that they do. They put up these quite big tents that fit 10 people in them. Okay. And they provide your water at every checkpoint. But beyond that, that's it. Oh, and they provide, obviously, a fire to be able to heat your water to go into your freeze-dried food. But, no, it's meant to be as self-supported as possible. You're meant to bring, like, all of your medical equipment. They'll have some stuff if you don't have it. But really, it's about trying to be reliant on yourself. And I don't know if that always gets... That message is always received by people. But I think if something's self-supported, it's probably a sign to the competitors that you need to probably be very prepared for what you're undertaking. You really need to know your body. You need to know how many electrolytes you need per water to be able to survive in that really hot, dry heat. And that's where the logistical side really comes in the preparation that you do before you even get there.
So did the race directors have a minimum of things that you had to bring as far as calories or
yes.
items?
Okay. Yeah, you have to bring 2,000 calories a day for food, which in some respects is a bit weird to have a 2,000 calorie requirement when some people are 100 pounds and then some people are, 160 pounds. I'm kind of on the bottom of that scale. And I was like, why do I need 2,000 calories and the next person next to me the same amount and they double my size? But that's the rules. You need to have, a compass, which I can't even read a compass. So my compass was just so little because I didn't want to carry a very heavy one. And if they asked me to read it, I probably couldn't have even seen where the pin went. I don't know if that's a very good advertisement there. Then I had, you have to have a certain amount of clothing in terms of one pair of tights, one long sleeve top, which is kind of a thermal top. The clothing requirements are pretty limited, and I wore the same clothes every single day I was racing. You almost had to burn them at the end because they smell so bad. And then there was just, you had to take a knife, like a small kind of knife, I suppose, and then a blister kit, because one of the biggest reasons that people pull out of these races is because they get blisters.
We were planning on asking you about how you guys avoid blisters when you're out running the desert.
Yeah, for the first race in the Atacama, I wore some shoes that just did not work for me. Maybe it was the combination of the salt flats, but they just didn't. I got so many blisters. I remember looking at my feet afterwards going, I think I'm going to have to, chop my feet off because I can't even walk on them. And I was getting a blood blister by the very end, and I think the race had gone one day longer, I would have been pulled out of the race because my feet were too bad. But then every other race, I wore like very simple, easy shoes, Brooks Cascadias, and I never got one blister after that. So that was kind of, I suppose, my saving grace in the end. But yeah, people get some pretty bad blisters, and the best way that I prevented them is I would always, obviously kind of file my toenails back in the week before the race, because you never want to do it just before. And then I would always put Hydrapel or, Body Glide or some kind of lubricant, all through my toes and on my heels. And then I would wear in gingy socks. And then you always wear shoes that are about 1.5 sizes too big, because by the end of the race, your feet are so swollen from accumulative days of running. So sometimes I would need to then wear another pair of socks on top of my gingies to kind of fill out my shoes to begin with. That was kind of my strategy, and it worked really well.
Angie loves in gingy socks.
I do. Do you know, secret?
I wear them under my work boots or my sometimes, not ones that aren't covering the ankle. But yeah, I love them. I think they become really addictive to be able to have your shoe, I mean, each toe separately protected.
I agree. I agree. It's hard to go back to normal socks.
Yeah, it is.
So what did you feel with during the runs?
You know, I didn't know what I was doing when I did the Four Deserts. I think I made a lot up and I learned. It was like a massive learning curve very quickly. For me, I didn't respond very well with freeze-dried food. I'm a pescatarian, so I don't eat meat, but I eat fish. But there was no way I was going to eat any, you know, freeze-dried fish out in the desert. sounds pretty awful. Some people did and it was a bad choice. So for me, I would craving a lot of salts. But if you saw from the film, like my – well, you don't know me normally, but I'm quite like puffy in the face. And I think I had the wrong balance of electrolytes and salts for what my body needed. And so I would, you know, I really craved salt vinegar crisps. And so I would crunch up a whole big bag of chips and I would put them in a Ziploc bag and I would just have them each day. I would have a hot chocolate, ramen noodles. I mean, this sounds like an appalling diet, not a great way of fueling your body if you're going to run this kind of distance. But a lot of the work is done in what you eat in the lead up to it. So I would have a really clean diet before the race, and then I would kind of, I suppose, abuse it based on what I could carry. For me, it was very challenging. You know, I couldn't take, you know, a block of cheese or some people did. Some people took a block of Parmesan and like a salami stick and some crackers, but I just could not carry it. I'm around the 100-pound mark, and it's just I'm essentially carrying about 25% of my body weight on the first day, and it really slows you down. That's why you start to, if you see in the film, like people are shuffling because they can't actually lift their feet off the ground with that amount of weight.
Hmm. It's amazing that a person could run it without any weight, you know, and then just adding that pack, I'm sure it really ups the challenge, man.
Yes. So if you train, and maybe I didn't do this well enough leading into it because I didn't know what I was doing, but if you train with a pack, then you're in a much better position to be able to run like a normal person because you get used to it. There's a Czech marathon runner from years and years ago who would always win these races, and they would ask him at the end of the interviews when he finished the race, why did you win? And he said, because I trained in army boots. That's what happens when you come off one of these, you know, multi-stage races. You take the backpack off and you fly because he's so used to having to carry additional weight.
I wonder if that was Emil Zatopek that you were...
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
He was amazing. Let's move on to now your decision to do all the desert races in the,
yeah,
in the series. Why did you decide to do that? And tell us about what the other deserts were like.
Yeah, do you know, now I look back, I'm like, I don't know what made me kind of think I could make it happen. I had everything that would make it very challenging, but I was living in the States after I finished the Atacama Desert. I suppose I was doing a three-month internship in a Capitol Defense Office. And whilst I was there, I kept dreaming about the desert. I felt like I had very unfinished business because I couldn't really run the first race. And so I just started to investigate, and when I started to see that really no female had ever completed all four in a year, but that year someone was trying, two people were, and I thought, oh, if it's ever going to be the year when I give it a shot, this is the year. And so I started to kind of reach it because I obviously couldn't afford. I was a volunteer for 3 months in the States. Like I could not afford the race fees and the flights. And so I just started to connect with different companies and trying to see if there was an opportunity for me to be sponsored. And I didn't attempt to be sponsored through being like an amazing elite athlete. It was more about being an everyday person doing something, you know, quite different and being capable of being able to share that story. Yeah. And that's kind of the angle I went. And, yeah, I got to the next race in China with 2 weeks prep.
You were able to pick up sponsors before?
Yes, I picked up one kind of really, really major sponsor. I had like product sponsors, uh-huh, and then I was given one financial sponsor, which I could not have done it without them. So I was super lucky.
Awesome.
Super, super. Now that I see, I mean, that was a bit of maybe foolish luck. If I knew what I knew now, or know now about what it takes to get sponsored, maybe I would never have tried, because it's very challenging to be able to get financially sponsored. Product sponsorship is one thing, and I think that's far easier, but financial sponsorship is like a different beast. I suppose I'm eternally grateful for that person, that company, for kind of seeing something in me and letting me kind of take on that journey. And then in exchange, I do a lot of, you know, corporate speaking. So that's, you know, you've got to find the way, if you want to be sponsored, of how doing what you can do equates to the value of whatever sponsorship dollar you get. You know, nothing's for free in this world, and it's always a relationship.
Right.
That's kind of my tips out there for people who want to be sponsored.
What was the next desert that you...
China. Oh, right. Gosh. China was hard. It was like a mountain race. I had kind of romanticized the experience of being out in the Atacama, and it was, you know, relatively flattish. And then I get to China, and the first day it's just these hills on grass. And I was like, I am so underprepared. What am I doing out here? This isn't romantic. This is actually very, very hard. And that was probably the first time, and really the only time, that I said, I don't know if I can finish this race or the series. But somehow I did. I actually met Dave really well in the Gobi Desert. And Dave's in the Desert Runners film. He's an Irishman, kind of in his 50s. And I don't know, he just kind of like, well, we're going up one of these hills, and I think I was crying, which in the film I cry a little bit. And he kind of gave me a little bum tap and just started singing a song. And we got our way up to the top of the mountain. And I was like, oh, that's okay, I can do this, and kind of ran down. And that's how it is for a lot of these races. You get to a really hard place, and you somehow have to mentally, like, just build yourself up to continue. And China was very, very different. It was nowhere near as beautiful as Atacama. You were often running through villages, which is really, I suppose, interesting on a cultural level. I met a really great runner from New Zealand, Lisa Tamati, in that race. And I suppose I learned a lot about ultramarathons by running with her in that event. And that was, I suppose, I feel like she was probably a big reason why I finished in the place that I did in that race.
Yeah, I can recall scenes from the movie with you guys looking like you're both barely alive, running in China, holding hands.
I know. I just can't believe the camera was there at that time.
What was it like having a camera crew follow you around? I mean, I can imagine, you know, when you're just tapping the end of your resources and then you've got this camera on you. What was that like?
Yeah. Well, they weren't there all the time. I mean, so that camera, in that scene that you're talking about, Lisa and I were lost for a long time. We were by ourselves. We couldn't see anyone. The checkpoint was like 4 to 5 Ks longer than they said it would be. And that doesn't sound like a lot, but when you're doing a 110-kilometer stage, well, it's meant to be 100, and that stage ended up being 110. You know, 4 Ks is a lot when you ration out your water. Mm-hmm. And we couldn't see the checkpoint for ages. And all of a sudden, you know, we're going this long stretch, and it's dusty, and it's like 7 p.m. at night, and it just got hotter than it had been at any point in the day. And we just grabbed each other's hands, kind of dragging ourselves on this dirt road in the middle of nowhere. And then we see the checkpoint in the distance. And that's when the film crew and Jen Steinman, the filmmaker, was in a car behind us, just came up because they'd been with Ricky and the other guys. And they saw us, and Jen said that she was like, get your camera and follow those girls. And they just ran after us, and, you know, they probably were walking next to us and we were running, filming it. But I didn't feel the camera was in the way. Like, they filmed a lot more than just the four people who were in the film. And so they were spread out by hours along the course. And the best example for that is when I finished the 110K stage in China, it was 2 a.m. in the morning, and the last person to finish that day finished at 3 p.m. the following day. Mm-hmm. So it gives an idea of how far stretched out the competitors are. And the support vehicles and the film crew, and when I say film crew, it was just one cameraman and Jen, the filmmaker, they were in a vehicle, and often the vehicle would only go forward because you'd be caught in a sand dune. So they had to really, I suppose, space themselves out, and I think they're quite lucky that they ended up catching the stories that they caught. But, I mean, hey, if you go out to an ultramarathon with people who are inexperienced, or, you know, you're going to see a lot of stuff out there, and that's exactly what happened.
Yeah, I think they caught a lot of amazing moments.
Yeah.
Was it during that race that the man died? And
yeah.
I was trying to think of which one it was. Yeah, that was really, really horrible.
That's exactly right. It was horrible. Nick... Nick ended up kind of passing out during the, I suppose, losing consciousness on the fourth stage, so before the long day. And it was a very, very, very hot day. I can't even describe to you the heat of that day. And we were going through some slot canyons that were so narrow. I mean, I found them narrow. I can't even imagine what guys who are 6 foot like found them narrow. I'm like 4'11.5". And so it just, it was a very, very hot, stifling day. And we found out after the race that Nick had passed away. And yeah, it was one of the very horrific things to happen during the year.
Yeah, I could see how that would just really cast a dark shadow over the whole event for everybody.
When that happens, the natural kind of step for your brain to go is, am I putting myself at danger? Is what am I doing for an experience or as a means to test my own limitations? Am I being foolish and am I being unfair to my family and in a sense also to my sponsors? And you know, you see in the film all of us kind of going through that thought process of what does this really mean? Is there a way that I can protect myself? And I mean, I was a law student at the time, so I'm always about risk mitigation. But it's about being very self-aware, I think, these races. And with the popularization of ultramarathon in general, you know, I do get fearful of, you know, more incidences happening where people maybe aren't prepared or are pushing too hard and aren't able to pull back. And some of these races do take you to isolated locations that aren't always quickly accessible by vehicle. And you know what? The population loves that. We love to go as deep and deep as we can go into like being without support or on the edge of our comfort zone. But there is that fine line, and I think people... I mean, after that experience, I said to myself, I need to imagine that no one can rescue me. And with that mentality, every decision I make needs to be on the basis that I have to get myself out of that situation. And obviously, I have my own fair share of incidences along the way as well. And you can't mitigate everything. But I think you've got to have the idea that you need to be so on top of your hydration. You need to eat before you need to eat. And sometimes you need to slow before you think you need to slow down, which means that impacts potentially you being a competitor. But at the end of the day, this is just running, and I don't think it's worth pushing myself so hard that there's a point of no return.
So what did some of your friends and your family think about you doing these races?
I think it's hard to understand unless... Now that the film's come out, they understand it. You get to write blogs, and so people are sharing your, I suppose, adventure through what you choose to tell them in your blogs. Mm-hmm. But we write these blogs in these tents after we've finished running, and you can get quite emotional. Like, you're sitting in the tent, and sometimes you can see comments from the previous day's blogs from your friends and family. And so there's people, like, crying and laughing, and they're, like, writing their blogs, and you're so tired. And so there's not really a filter sometimes. And then some people don't share much at all. But I think, I suppose, the natural thing is to think that you're crazy to do what you're doing. But you can't share the experiences all the time. I think some of my friends and family understood, and some had no idea.
Well, take us to the two other deserts, the Sahara Desert and Antarctica, right?
Yeah, so Sahara, I think, is possibly the easiest of the four. Okay. But it's also the time when I was the smelliest in my entire life. There's just so much sand. There's so much sand and so much wind, and you're sweating, and so then that sand is stuck on you, and then, oh, it's just, I can almost smell what it smelled like. But it was a beautiful race in the sense that you can see nothing for like kilometers and kilometers into the distance. And it makes you feel quite insignificant as a person because you're running and you can't even see the checkpoint markers. But it was a hard race. It was the third race of the series. And all the people who were trying to do the four deserts started to feel the toll that it was accumulatively taking on the body. Mm-hmm. I think Paul, in the film, makes a really good comment saying, you know, you start these races each time and you think you're in good shape because you've rested, and then all of a sudden you realize that you've just done, you know, 500 kilometers in a period of a few months in a place where you have to fly to. The travel really wears onto you, and the fact that when you finish the travel you have to then get back to the real world and work and study. And for me, I was doing my law exams in that break time. And so I would always come to the races really tired, or I'd be quickly trying to finish an assignment before I would like get on the bus to go to the start line. And so I think Sahara was challenging for that respect, and you still knew that you had to get through another 250 kilometres, 155 miles before you could, you know, before you could get to Antarctica. And when you got to Antarctica, I think all of us realised that we would make it. We would be able to finish the series.
So was it really a physical shock to go from three, you know, really hot climates into Antarctica? I mean, what was that like?
Very cold. Very, very cold. It was only 3 weeks between Sahara and the last race. And so you had literally just gotten back home, and then your brain had to switch into getting cold weather gear. And that was just, I mean, I live in Australia. The weather is not that cold. And so for me, I didn't even know what kind of clothing I needed, and it was such a battle just finding the different layers. But it was hard preparing for that. But at the same time, it was super exciting. I mean, we flew down to Argentina. We were in a shire, and then we catch a boat going through the Drake's Passage to get there. And I mean, that's just, I was 25 years of age at that time, or maybe I just turned 26, and I was like, this is just spectacular. I can't believe I'm here. And so I just felt eternally grateful that whole race and didn't want to take any of it for granted. But that race was all about the, you know, unknown. You never knew how many kilometres you would be running, because you were always at the mercy of, I suppose, the volatile nature of the area. So sometimes we were told we'd have to start at 5 a.m. and then we'd all get dressed, have our food. We'd be waiting to get off onto the smaller boats to get to the shore, and they'd be like, no, the weather's not good enough, we'll start in 2 hours. And then it went, no, we'll start in another 2 hours. And you're kind of like, oh, I don't, you know, it's hard to mentally prepare yourself for something that you don't know. And I think sometimes you mentally become a little bit weaker because you keep thinking that they're going to stop you. And so when you're hurting, you're like, oh, well, they're going to stop me soon enough anyway, so I can allow myself to feel this pain. Really interesting for the mind on that race.
How do you think your mindset has changed, you know, about just thinking about life and challenges that you're facing now? I think your mindset has changed after completing all these desert races.
A few things. I think that I truly believe now from doing that, if I can look from the outside, that if I really want something, I'm very capable of being able to put something together, even if it's going to be immensely challenging. And that, you know, maybe I didn't realize how challenging that year was going to be until I was in the middle of it. And so I had a little bit of naivety in kind of pursuing, you know, the finance, the logistics, the actual undertaking on my body. And so I think that's a sense of strength I have finishing that. But on the flip side, I also realize that it's, you know, I know that boundary of how far I want to push myself, and that you can't always push yourself to capacity. So maybe I'm a little bit more cautious now than I was when I did those races. I've continued running since doing the Four Deserts. The year after, I did a nonstop 222-kilometer race in the Himalayas, and the elevation reached 18,000 feet above sea level.
Wow.
It was like running with socks in your mouth. It was just a whole, it was really, it was very, very hard, surprisingly. And then, I mean, this year I'm running 2,500 kilometres from Pietermaritzburg to Cape Town in South Africa, and I'm running with a lady from the UK called Mimi Anderson, and it's not a race. We're just doing about 70 to 80 kilometres every day for 32 days, and we're using that run to be able to raise awareness to the fact that women in sub-Saharan Africa don't have access to affordable feminine hygiene products. So our goal through this 32-day adventure is to raise enough funds to set up a social business in the Free State province in South Africa, and where we're going to employ women to manufacture affordable products and then distribute them at low cost to girls within that community. And the whole purpose of it is to try and keep girls in school. And I suppose if I had never had done the Four Deserts, I would never even contemplate the idea that you could use running to further, I suppose, passions in areas of social advocacy, which I've always had through studying law. And now I've combined two different passions, I suppose. And, you know, some people say, what's the connection between running and social advocacy? And I said to someone the other day, the link, there doesn't need to be a link to begin with, but there is a link that you're using something as an advertising campaign. You're using running, which intrigues people and makes people stop. If I was just trying to raise money to set up a business in the Free State and I wasn't running, I could guarantee you I would not raise the amount of funds that I would raise if I'm running. And so I suppose that's kind of where I take my running now. I mean, I still race, but really it's far more about these longer expeditions that are kind of connected to other causes.
Awesome. One final question we have is just for people listening to this, your story is really inspiring. Just as you describe yourself, just an average runner, not particularly athletic, but you had this big dream and you started taking action and you have done some amazing things. How can others make their dreams become a reality?
Well, the first one is I think you have to really want it. I think a lot of people have like these, they look at what someone else is doing and it might seem appealing, but they think it's so far removed from their capabilities. But I don't think it's about it being removed from their capabilities. I think it's removed from their actual desire to make it happen. So I think the first thing is to really, really want something and to just and not to be a fanciful idea, to be a true idea that's connected to who you are as a person. And then I would say the people that you interact with are going to be a huge source of motivation or lack of motivation. You know, I'd say I have an amazing network of friends who don't always understand my running. They might think it's weird, but they just really believe in me and they see that this is what I love to do. And so they, I suppose, push me to kind of keep raising the bar of what's possible. And they give me ideas and they don't tell me I'm crazy. And well, they might say I'm crazy, but they don't dismiss it as something that's possible, even if it's something that's kind of different. Mm-hmm. And then I think the next one is to just be willing to work really, really hard for it and to accept the fact that there's going to probably be a lot of challenges along the way that will, for a lot of people, would probably stop them. I mean, for this project in South Africa, Mimi and I, so Mimi's an incredible runner. She's 51 years of age from the UK and she started running in her 30s and she's done a double bad water, you know, she attempted double spartathlon last year. Wow. She broke the record for running across Ireland. She's an incredible athlete and an amazing woman. But we've had more challenges setting up this South Africa project. And to be honest, it's because we're doing something for, you know, that's focusing on feminine hygiene. It's kind of a bit uncomfortable for people to talk about. And so it's been very hard for us to ascertain the different things that we need along the way. But I think if you just believe in it so much, you're willing to take knockbacks, even if it causes a bit of stress, to be able to make it happen. Because you just, in some ways, there's just no other option. It's just it's the way it's got to be. I think the concept for that is resilience.
Yeah.
The capacity to be able to bounce back from, you know, great adversity and challenges and to actually thrive through that.
So is running a marathon like super easy for you now?
No. You know, it's never easy because whatever distance you do, you're always running to your limits or to your capabilities. So you're always at your threshold. So a 5K run, I mean, yes, a 5K run is easier on the mind because you know it's going to be over much quicker. But I'm not very used to doing quick 5Ks and that can really hurt, and that can hurt me. So no, every distance is still hard. There's some ultra marathon runners that, you know, you might see on Facebook and they write, oh, I just did 20K today. And I'm like, you know what? It's never just. It's always 20K. It's always amazing. And we're always so lucky to have, you know, the legs and feet that we have to be able to move us in that kind of way. And I don't take that, you know, you see friends who are injured and I'm sure you've been injured along your running journey as well. And it takes a massive mental toll on you. So I feel always very lucky to be able to run.
We do too. Well said. If people want to find you online somewhere, where would they go?
So Samantha Gash, just all lowercase.com is my website. But for this project I've talking about in South Africa, it's freedomrunners.org. And there's heaps. We're sharing our journey. We've got a friend who's a crew member but was also filming content along the way. And we're going to be creating like short pieces about our experiences. You know, the story between Mimi and I, the people that we meet, the terrain we're running on. And so that's going to be a great little portal for different information if anyone's interested to follow.
Awesome. And we'll be sure to link to those websites over on our website. Well, Samantha, thank you for taking time to talk to us. And we kind of got you up this morning because it's like, you know, like how many hours different? Who knows? I mean,
just a few. Sorry, it's now light. It's now light, so it means time to go to work.
Sounds good. All right.
Okay.
Well, thank you so
Thanks
much,
for
Samantha.
Chat, guys.
Have a great day. Thank you.
You too. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Well, we hope you enjoyed that conversation with Samantha Gash. You can find her at SamanthaGash.com. So, Angie, what was your impression of Samantha? Pretty well-spoken lady, huh?
Very well-spoken, really a motivated individual, just a go-getter in all aspects of life.
Yeah. So what I liked about Samantha's story was she's not an elite runner. She wasn't somebody who had, like, won a marathon or was able to run really fast marathons. She was just an everyday runner like the rest of us who decided to go on this adventure and train really hard and do a lot of research and planning to make it happen and do her money raising and everything that had to happen, but just made her dreams and goals become a reality and just was awesome.
I think that if you have goals and you're determined and willing to work hard enough that you can achieve them, you don't have to start out by doing the Four Deserts Grand Slam by any stretch of the imagination.
Right.
But just start with your goals. You know, maybe they're smaller, but, you know, they can build. And pretty soon you can be doing incredible things yourself. I think another takeaway is that if you wait for the perfect time in your life to do something, it may never arrive. So you just have to kind of make it work.
That's very wise, Angie, because she mentioned she was trying to finish up her exams or something, or her finals, while she was on her way to the first race. So that's not good timing.
Exactly. There's always a reason why you shouldn't do it this year or why you should wait. But I think with some creativity and being willing to put in the work and the effort and educate yourself, that it is a possibility, whatever it is you're shooting for.
I would hate to get to the end of my life, too, and wonder, what if? You know, what if I would have done that? That dream I always had that I never took action on. What if I would have done it?
What is that saying that most people regret the things they didn't do rather than the things they did or something
That's
like
right.
that?
Well, now it's time for this episode's quick tip. And we want to tell you about a movie that will inspire you to be awesome. The movie is called Desert Runners. And it's the movie that Samantha talked about on the interview that features her and some other runners. You can find this movie at desertrunnersmovie.com. They have a digital download there. I'm not sure how much it costs. But they did give us a discount code for all of our listeners. If you enter the code RUNNERS, that's RUNNERS with an S, you get 10% off the digital download of the movie Desert Runners. Angie, what did you think of this movie?
I thought it was great. I really enjoyed it. I was sucked in. It was great cinematography and interesting, compelling stories of the different runners they followed.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was definitely inspiring.
You should see what people's feet look like who are doing these races. It was brutal. Angie, do you remember when they were taking their shoes off and kind of nursing their blisters and stuff?
Yes.
It's worth the movie just to see people's mangled feet. And they're coming out with a new one. It's called Desert Runners. It's about a guy who runs from one Dunkin' Donuts to the next.
Right.
And I'm that guy. Actually, I'm a fat adapted runner. I haven't had dessert in so long. Cut out sugars. It's feeling good. How about you, Angie?
Yes. Glad I'm no longer enslaved to sugar.
This has nothing to do with our quick tip, but let me ask you this, Angie. You have gone without chocolate now for how many weeks?
Nearly four.
So when we started the Fat Adapted Eating Plan, we do allow 86% dark chocolate, which would probably taste pretty bitter to most people, but tastes really sweet once you get fat adapted. So Angie's not even eating that now. I don't even know who you are anymore, Angie.
Yes, well, I'm trying to experiment with some different food intolerances that I have and see if
right.
eliminating a couple things from my diet would help. So it's not forever. I hope to be back with my beloved dark chocolate again sometime soon.
Well, keep up the good work, and I know it's not easy. Well, we just want to encourage all of you who are taking time to train, to put in the hard work, to put in the hours and the miles. It will be worth it. The payoff is great. Think about the lady who ran a marathon at 91. I hope that we can all live a long, happy, and healthy life. We're glad to be on this journey with you. Thank you for listening to this podcast. We just love connecting with folks in our audience and hearing from you, interacting with you on Facebook. We're thankful for all the Academy members who are training with us right now. And we want you to remember that you do have what it takes to run a marathon and change your life.